May it please the court, I'm Matthew Holman and I represent the people in this matter. The issue before the court today is whether a conspiracy to distribute a controlled substance is an extraordinary risk crime under the extraordinary risk statute. There are two statutes that I'm going to talk about quite a bit here. One is that extraordinary risk provision, which is 18.1.3.401.10b in its Roman numeral 11. And then the other is the controlled substance statute 18.18.405, principally 1A, but some other parts as well. And I'm going to try to refer to them. One is the extraordinary risk provision, and one is the offense provision, just to simplify it down quite a bit. And I'll try to be consistent in that. But that's the shorthand I'm planning to use. Now, before I get to the issue, I want to give the court a little bit of background on how we arrived at this issue. Now, the defendant in this case pled guilty to two offenses. One was first-degree kidnapping with a related crime of violence count. The other was conspiracy to distribute a Schedule II controlled substance. Now, the kidnapping sentence is not at issue here. The only sort of intertwining of the two that's, again, not relevant to the issue but interesting is that the parties agreed that the aggregate sentence for the two crimes would be between 16 and 48 years, and that is what was given. Now, the defendant's plea to conspiracy to distribute a controlled substance had several components to it. One is it included an admission that the amount involved was between 25 and 450 grams. He also admitted that he was on parole at the time of the offense, which increases the sentencing range to the midpoint in the presumptive range to twice the maximum in the presumptive range. And the parties also agreed that this was an extraordinary risk crime. Now, skipping over the math that gets you there, essentially the components of the extraordinary risk crime and the parole, that he was on parole aggravator, what we get is a sentencing range of the midpoint of the presumptive range. I guess I should go back and say the extraordinary risk enhancer increases the top of the sentencing range in the presumptive range by 4 years. So that would be 4 to 16 years. However, the parole aggravator requires that the sentence be in the midpoint of the presumptive range up to a maximum of twice the presumptive range. And so what we end up with is a 10 to 32 year sentencing range. Now, the Court of Appeals, sua sponte, raised an issue for the parties, which was, does the extraordinary risk provision in fact apply to the conspiracy to distribute a controlled substance offense? And the court ultimately ruled that it did not apply. And the reasoning it used were two parts. One was that it found that the controlled substance, the offense provision, sets forth three categories of criminal conduct, and the extraordinary risk provision is intended to apply only to the first category. And that category does not include the conspiracy count. The other reason that the court relied on was a case called People versus Blinderman. Now, in Blinderman, the defendant had been convicted of attempted distribution, and the Court of Appeals held that that was not subject to extraordinary risk sentencing because the extraordinary risk provision does not include an attempt, and there isn't, by the way, an attempted distribution method of committing the offense within the offense provision, although the court did not address that. So it used those two components to find that this was not an extraordinary risk offense. However, the reasoning applied by the court is incorrect. First, the statute doesn't create three categories of substantive for substantive purposes of application of the extraordinary risk enhancer. The organization of the statute is actually seems to be more driven by grammar than a substantive structure, and there's certainly no indication in the extraordinary risk provision that it's intended to apply to a category within that section. I think the way this court described it in Abiodun was exactly right, and this court said that this statutory provision outlining the offense is one where, quote, a set of acts are joined as a disjunctive series in a single sentence without any attempt to differentiate them by name or other organizational device. And then the court went on to say, the entire range of conduct is criminalized in a single subsection of a statute entitled simply unlawful distribution, manufacture, dispensing, sale, or possession. So there simply isn't a breakdown of separate organizational categories here. But I think the point that comes out of that...
But wait a minute. Aren't you just ignoring the actual structure of the... I guess it's a single sentence with the semicolons, and perhaps you're ignoring... If you're talking about the offense section, are you not?
Sure, I am.
Well, it's clearly organized in three categories. I suppose the question might be, what's the significance of that categories? But I don't see how you can deny that it creates... That it's written in three separate parts, divided by semicolons.
I agree, Your Honor. It is written in three separate parts, and I sort of glossed through that. But I think again, that's simply a grammatical organization to make it logically make sense. And I don't think the legislature intended to make them isolated, especially in this particular context, for particular application of the extraordinary risk.
Yeah, but isn't that sort of insignificant? I mean, isn't the question whether in the extraordinary risk section that intention is required in some fashion? I mean, because it's in three parts and it has no significance in terms of the offense section, but what you should be addressing, it seems to me, is whether the extraordinary risk section's reference to the offense section is written in that manner and has that intent.
All right. I will do that. I would just want to say one thing before I turn to that, which is I think the flaw in the analysis, pardon me, of the Court of Appeals was that they seem to say it applies to that first category, assuming it's a category, but that category is actually broader than what the extraordinary risk provision seems to apply. The offense provision includes simple possession. Now, if the Court of Appeals is correct that it's intended to apply the entire category, that would seem to undermine the language of the extraordinary risk provision, which indicates that it applies to possession with intent to, and I'm going to simplify it way down, distribute or manufacture a controlled substance. So I think even that logic doesn't work. But I want to turn now to what your question was, which is, what does the language in the extraordinary risk provision mean? And what I was about to say was that Abby Odin points out that essentially there's this group of conduct put under this title of unlawful distribution, et cetera, et cetera. And if you look at the language of the extraordinary risk provision, it mirrors that very language with one exception, again, that it narrows possession to ones involving the intent to sell, distribute, manufacture a controlled substance. So I think when you look at those two together, I think the extraordinary risk provision is intended to encompass all of those distribution, sale, manufacturing offenses that can be committed in some fashion under the one single sentence of the offense provision.
Mr. Holman, it doesn't include the inchoate offenses, though. Attempt or conspiracy, right? Just the plain language.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I think...
So why would we read that in?
The reason... why would we read that in?
Yeah.
Wouldn't we
be creating legislation if we did that?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. And the reason is I think the intent of that section, by using, again, the language of the title, is to incorporate all the various methods of committing the offense that involve distribution, sale, and manufacturing. And conspiracy to distribute is one of those methods of committing it, and it's included in the... offense itself. It's not requiring a separate conspiracy charge or relying on a separate statute. So I think the language is broad enough to encompass the conspiracy.
Mr. Holman, if I understand your argument, it is essentially that the extraordinary risk section, the beginning language of that is actually a reference to, shall we say, the title of the offense section. Is that what you're saying?
I think that's correct. I think I might say it this way, which is it's intended to identify all those offenses that are intended to be encompassed by, I think, the title, which I think essentially subsumes all of 1A of the offense provision, but narrowing it again as far as possession to only ones with the intent to sell or manufacture. I think that the language is so unique and it so mirrors that must be the intent there.
And I guess I want you to talk about the possession with intent a little bit, because I mean, that sounds to me a pretty good argument, except for the qualification of possession with intent, because of course the caption doesn't include that. And it's a pretty good argument to me, because some of the other sections sort of reference that way in the extraordinary risk provision. That is, they seem to reference the crime by its caption and then as defined by. So that there's a nice little parallel there, but that whole attempt to distinguish possession from the possession with intent to sell, distribute, manufacture, or dispense sort of, it seems to me, puts a real kink in that argument. And I'm not sure I quite understand what you're doing with that.
Sure. And I've thought about that quite a bit, Your Honor. I think again, we get up to possession, and I think that language is all exactly mirrors the title. And then I think the legislature, you know, efficiently is saying, but we're narrowing that component to only those that involve the intent to distribute and sell and manufacture. And I think...
We see that this is such a dangerous argument, it seems to me, because if they're narrowing possession, why aren't they also narrowing, you know, in terms of eliminating anything else they haven't mentioned in that section?
Well, let me answer that in this way, which is, I think under that, my interpretation, what they've essentially done is eliminated the various forms of simple possession under the statute. And what they've taken out is simple possession, inducing someone to possess, or a conspiracy to simply possess. I think the language together, both, one shows that they are interested in the broader topic of distribution and manufacturing, and in fact, the possession one supports that's the scope of that, that is the overall encompassing of those offenses that involve distribution or manufacturing. Now, I just want to briefly touch on the Blinderman case, which I guess I've talked about, which is I just don't think it applies here, and because it involves a case where they had to go to a separate attempt statute to get the attempt in here, unlike our situation where the conspiracy is built into the offense itself. So I think there's not a problem there. Now, I wanted to address some language that frankly is a little troubling to my argument, but I think, you know, I don't think we either of us have addressed it in our briefs, and I think what we focus on primarily is what the Court of Appeals did and why we think that reasoning is right or wrong. And these are two provisions in the offense. And one is section 3.5. which refers back to the extraordinary risk provision. And this language would seem to counter my argument. It says the felony offense of unlawfully manufacturing, dispensing, selling, distributing, manufacture, dispense, sell, or distribute a controlled substance is an extraordinary risk crime. Now that seems to narrow it to those methods of committing it, rather than what I think is the correct understanding of the extraordinary risk provision, which is this broader encompassing, that it's those particular specific means of committing the offense. And there's language like that also in 3A. But now I'm going to say, and that bothered me, and I thought, well, maybe this is a problem, and frankly, I didn't think about it a lot when I was writing the brief, but I thought about it when I was getting ready for argument. And I thought, well, maybe I'm wrong about this, but I think I'm wrong about being wrong, and I'll tell you why. And I have 39 seconds to do it, so I'll try to be fast. I think the Banks case that this court issued about the extraordinary risk crime of violence statute, we glean from that a principle, which is it's the extraordinary risk provision itself that defines its scope, that it's not other statutes that talk about crimes of violence. And I think that applies here. That's the extraordinary risk provision defines its own scope. And there's a statutory construction rule that codifies this principle. which is section 24205 of the statutes. And I'm about out of time. May I finish my comment, Your Honor?
Sure.
All right.
Go ahead.
All right. And that provision says that when you have two statutes that seemingly conflict, the more specialized one controls over the more general. Now, in this case, the extraordinary risk provision is the more specific. It's the one that tells us the scope of that. The controlled substance provision is directed toward the broader, general topic of the commission of the controlled substance offenses. And its references are simply references back to the extraordinary risk provision, which I think is the controlling provision. That's all I have, Your Honor. Thank you very much for your time.
May I proceed?
May it please the court, my name is Jamie V. Hill, attorney registration 34362. I represent the respondent, Robert Valenzuela, in this matter. I'd like to begin by, and I will, for sake of argument, identify the provisions, the statutory provisions in the same way, with the offense provision being 18.18.405, and the extraordinary risk provision being 18.1.3.401, subsection 10b.11. And I also will address the Blinderman issue because I think that is important, but I'd like to start with the three categories. I don't think it is just a category, a grammatical tool. And I think if we look directly at 18.18.405, which this court has done previously in Abiodun, we find that there are three types of conduct. They do have some different elements to be proven. They are similar. They are not mutually exclusive. They do have overlap, but they represent three different methods or ways of violating the statute. And I think that the Court of Appeals correctly called them categories or alternative ways of violating this one statute. I think the best evidence for that interpretation actually comes from the statute itself. If you look at subsection 2 of the offense provision, basically, subsection 1 identifies these three methods, and everything after that refers to how to identify or define sentencing for those three methods. And subsection 2 does talk about how to identify the severity or the level of felony for those categories. And what it states is that, quote, any violation of subsection 1 of this section, end quote. So it covers all of the categories. It's calling them violations. All of the categories is included under that subsection. Then you look at subsection 3, which is also related to sentencing. It involves increasing the presumptive range of the sentencing based on quantity and drug type. And the language specifically used there states that it expressly applies to the first two categories. It does not identify them as violations. It actually states the language of the first two categories of conduct. There's no mention of the third way of violating the statute under that subsection, and that would be the possession of the supplies and chemicals. Then you look at subsection 3A, which is another sentencing provision under the offense statute, and it talks about the extraordinary risk provision. And it states that the extraordinary risk provision expressly applies to the first category, and it does so by expressly using the language of the first category. It does not mention the language of the third way of violating the statute or the second way of violating the statute. It just mentions the first way. That language is again found in the extraordinary risk provision. So I do think that is significant. I think that since we're looking to find harmony between these statutes, what you have is in 18.18.405, the offense provision, are clearly the intent to identify to state that these violations are not all sentenced uniformly, that they do have variation. And then, again, the extraordinary risk provision mirrors that, showing the first type of prescribed conduct. The statute is unique, and I think what is really unique about the statute really is not is really that it's set up to be flexible with sentencing. It assumes, I think, that all of the drug offenses are serious, and but the severity of sentencing for drug offenses is going to be assessed on a case-by-case basis. It's factually based, and that is what comes out in the offense statute 1818-405. It's based on quantity of drugs, type of drugs, history of the defendant. That is what determines, goes into sentencing. So the statute is set up to be very flexible. And I think that just because we are talking about conspiracy, which traditionally conspiracy or generally conspiracy crimes are typically punished less severely than a substantive offense, it does make sense that there should be this flexibility to have this case-by-case analysis. In terms of the Blinderman case, I think what Mr. Holman was arguing was that that Blinderman does not support the holding of the Court of Appeals because attempt, unlike conspiracy, is not wholly contained in 1818-405. And I think it is accurate that criminal attempt is not contained in 1818-405-1A, whereas conspiracy is. That I agree with. But I don't believe that the Court of Appeals was relying on Blinderman. I think they were relying on the language of the statute. The Blinderman analysis was simply supportive of their interpretation, and I do think that that the reasoning applies. What Blinderman was saying was that if you look at other sentence enhancement provisions, those provisions expressly state whether or not they apply to attempt. That language used to apply the section to attempt is not present in the extraordinary risk of harm provision, and if the General Assembly had intended to apply that provision to criminal attempt, they would have inserted that standard language that is found in the other sentence-enhancing provisions to show that it applied to attempt. And that, since the language was absent, extraordinary risk provision did not apply to attempt. That was Blinderman, but I think the logic is the same. Here we have the extraordinary risk provision, had the intent been to apply it to conspiracy, the standard language that is found in other sentence enhancement provisions, like the crime of violence statute, which does have statement in there saying that applies to offenses as committed, as conspired, to be committed, as attempted, that could have been included. I don't think that the language mirrors the title so much of the caption of this section. I think it actually more accurately mirrors the language of subsection 3.5 of the section of 1818-405. And it also mirrors the language more accurately, more closely, of the first, for lack of a better term, category of conduct that is prescribed under this this offense. In terms of the issue that was raised regarding the simple possession, I think 3.5 shows that this is the extraordinary risk is applying to felony offenses. It's not going to be applying to every type of drug offense that there is. And again, this goes back to it being a very flexible statute based on the circumstances of drug crimes, which take a variety of forms and are all serious.
Could I ask you one question about the possession? This 405 itself, in its penalty sections, actually distinguishes possession from all the other forms and makes it a much less serious offense. Does 405 distinguish any of the other acts and reduce the penalty for them?
I don't believe that it states any of the other acts are to be considered less serious. I think that it actually is the opposite. I think that it, the language would, there's language in subsection 3 as to when sentences should be aggravated, and then subsection 3.5, which is the extraordinary risk, again, which would aggravate a sentence. So for me, those would be, and also, I also would add that I do think that subsection 3 shows the intent to punish greater situations where you have drug trafficking, which again is based on quantity of the drug involved, the type of drug involved. So I do think there is evidence of indicated in the statute when it is to be punished greater, but I don't see language of lesser, if that makes sense. I did, in preparation for today, listen to the legislative history. I don't think it's necessary for resolution of this case because I think that the plain language of the statute, I think that if we're looking to harmonize the statutes, that it's I don't think you need to listen to that. I think it's in the statute, the intent is there. But I did listen to them. And under the, in terms of creating, consolidating these offenses into 18405, one of the sponsors stated that there was no substantive change being made to the offenses other than in regards to trying to target drug trafficking. And that was referring to subsection 3 with the quantities, the 25 grams to 450 grams issue. That was the only substantive change being made in consolidating the offenses. And for me, my understanding of what that would mean is that conspiracy then is, as it was before consolidation, still conspiracy. And although it is very serious, and all of these crimes are serious, that generally, traditionally, conspiracy, because it does not require completion of the substantive offense itself, it can be, and usually, generally is, punished lesser than completion or commission of the substantive offense.
But also separately from the completion of the crime, you wouldn't be arguing that the structure allows a separate conviction for conspiracy and also for possession with the intent to sell or whatever the other acts are, would you?
Are you asking if there's a double jeopardy issue or?
No, well, not really. I guess I'm asking if these are separate crimes and you think a defendant could be convicted separately of each.
Well, I think that they are alternate ways of violating the same statute, and I think that a defendant can be convicted or separately punished for successive violations of the same statute. So, in that sense, I think you could have, if the facts warrant it in that particular case. I think, again, it would depend on the case. I'm not arguing they are separate, totally separate offenses, because I think they're the way the statute is set up, they're separate violations of one statute. But I do think you can have two convictions for both if the facts are there, based on the fact that I think that defendants can be separately punished for successive violations of one statute. There has been cases, I think, I think it might have been Abiodun now that I'm thinking of it, where it was a possession and a distribution, which would be two convictions both for the same category, obviously. But
I don't think those were for the same quantum of drugs, though, where they
right,
weren't on different occasions.
Yeah. Right, and that, again, would go to if the facts warrant it. So. I don't think that there is, that just by grouping these together, that there is the automatic intention that they should be sentenced uniformly. Like I said, I think that it is a factually based analysis for drug offenses. I think that grouping them together was done to create the flexible structure of this statute. and because that they are not completely mutually exclusive. And I do think that this, nothing in the Court of Appeals decision contradicts the previous holding in Abiodun of this court. I think that the Court of Appeals decision is in line with this court's prior decisions. I think that the Blinderman analysis is not relied upon. It is not crucial to their analysis, but I think it is supportive of their analysis. So it is, there's no contradiction. But even if this court did not feel that they were similarly situated, such that with the attempt not being included in this specific offense, I still think that the statutory language is clear. I think that is all that I have, unless there's questions. I am out of time. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I thank counsel for your arguments. The case stands submitted.